lecture two of Coleoptera. Yeah, we just finished. What did we just finish with? Hydrophilidae and the Hysteridae. Now we're going into the superfamily Staphylinoidea. Again, I can tell you, Staphylinoidea, the superfamily, is characterized by their wing venation and form of the Malpighian tubules. They don't have a median cubitus loop, and they only have 4 to 6 simple Malpighian tubules. Again, I think that's more than what I'm just telling you that because there are some characters that define the superfamily, but it's not anything. I mean, usually the wings are, you can't see them because they're under the elytra, so that character doesn't help. And
nobody, Brooke has a couple of these.
Well, Brooke should have tons of them.
Well, tons, yes, but I've seen a few of them, and yeah.
I'm guessing what you're looking at. You're looking at the carrion beetles.
Well, yeah, carrion beetles, but...
Yeah. So, carrion beetles come to pitfall traps like crazy because of the dead stuff in it there. And so if you're running pitfall traps, you often get lots of carrion beetles. Our trap, sometimes the cup would just be overflowing with them. We got drawers and drawers. And
this would be an example of one.
They're bigger.
Yep.
We're talking.
I was thinking, do they come in varying sizes if they're bigger?
Yeah, most carrion beetles will be bigger than that. And, but I know Brooke ran them for her research.
Yeah, I helped her with that.
So the first family we will talk about is the family Sylphidae, or the carrion beetles. And as the name implies, they are attracted to carrion and feed on. Look at that, we got a working overhead. I did find a bulb that's meant to run this, and I think Diane was going to order some more too, so. These are moderate to large in size. The next family we get to is the Staphylinidae. They tend to be much, much smaller. But these are usually black or dark brown in color with oranges and reds and yellows markings on them. The antennae are usually clubbed. They may be capitate or clavate. Remember the difference between clavate and capitate? He's got the antennal types in there. That's good.
They increase in size slowly, ending in that club.
Oh, is that this is stuff we went over yesterday?
Well, that's why I told you need to.
Yep.
Make sure you know the different antennal types.
Yeah.
But clavate is a gradual club. Capitate is an abrupt club. So, the last three segments are usually pubescent. Now, sorry, blue pin here. Wonder where you got to. Anyway, oftentimes the elytra are shorter than the body, so the body sticks out at the end, but the elytra are longer than they are wide. So they're usually the elytra are longer than the combined width of the two elytra. They say may or may not cover the abdomen, but usually a little bit of the abdomen is sticking out. The tarsal formula is 5-5-5. The front coccyx are conical or somewhat more squarish, but they do project downwards. They are prominent. Like I said, these are carrion beetles. One place I've noticed them quite frequently is when I've been fishing and go to the fish houses to clean your fish, and they'll be attracted to the fish. Some are attracted to large carcasses. You know, actually, the first graduate student I ever had, when I first got here, he came within just a few weeks after I got here. His name is David Cuthrell, but he was interested. He did a project. His project was on insects associated with that western prairie fringed orchid, but he had a side interest in these burying beetles and carrion beetles. And every time we'd go out in the field, he had his carrion beetle kit. He had gloves to put on, and then he had long forceps. And if we'd see roadkill, it's always, "Oh, you gotta stop and let me look there." And so we were stopping at roadkill all the time, and he was picking out the beetles and that. But what I think got his interest in this group is that there is a species called the American burying beetle that is on the, in what at least used to be, I don't know how it's looked lately, but it was on the endangered list. And it was down to just, at least at one time, they thought it was down to just a couple small populations, like one way out in Rhode Island, I think, and then maybe one in Oklahoma. Now they've done a lot more collecting and surveying, and either it's come back or it's much more widespread. They found it in a number of places in Nebraska and some other states. But there is a record. We had a specimen or that was collected in the northwestern corner of Iowa, an older record. Well, northwestern corner of Iowa is really not that far from the southeastern corner of North Dakota. Mm-hmm. And so he did a lot of survey work down in the sand hills area. They kind of like the sandy soil, hoping to find the American burying beetle. He never did, but it was an interesting thing that he did. Well, little background, these burying beetles, the American burying beetle, they're attracted to smaller carcasses like mice, a dead mouse, and they'll actually kind of roll it up into a ball. They drag it off someplace and then they bury it down under the soil. There's several reasons, and dung beetles do the same thing, but why they bury something is, one, it helps keep it fresher and more moist rather than sitting out in the open air, but it also reduces competition. If they can get it off and away from everybody else and get it under the soil, then there's not other insects or animals coming to find it. It kind of isolates it, so it helps keeps it moist and it reduces competition. But these burying beetles will then bury these things, and it'll be like have a ball of carrion. And then they'll build a little tunnel off to the side, and that's where they actually lay their eggs, is in this tunnel. And then when the eggs hatch, the adults will still be in there on that carrion ball, and they stridulate, and that attracts the larvae to the carrion ball. And then they actually stay there and help feed the larvae and that, so there's some parental care in that. So it's a real interesting thing. What I didn't realize, the way Dave tried to survey for these things is he'd get some dead mice and he tied them to a rope, a little cord, and put a stick in the ground and tied the rope to that and just left them out. And then when he'd come back, you know, they'd be buried under the soil. And so he knew carrion beetles had come and buried them. Well, he'd start digging, and these things would actually bury these things like 2 or 3 feet deep. I didn't think it, you know, I didn't realize they might do that so deep, but they'd be way down in the soil in that. So, but we have a lot of species in that genus. It's the genus Necrophorus. In fact, they were working on a paper of the Necrophorus of North Dakota. In fact, maybe Alex got interested and was gonna help try to get that done too, I don't know. But we never did find the American burying beetle up here in North Dakota. So, so anyway, that's the Sylphidae. The next family in this superfamily is the Staphylinidae. The Staphylinidae is one of those families where you can usually recognize a staphylinid. It just, most of them, well, I should say in this handout, Jerry put a lot of the exceptions on there. Most staphylinids look like what you see on that top row. The ones on the bottom row are the oddballs. So staphylinids kind of, most of them just look like staphylinids. Long, slender, parallel-sided, with the wings, usually the elytra, quite short. So the abdomen sticks out beyond the end of the elytra. And here, now you can see, in a lot of these, the length of the elytra is shorter than the width. So oftentimes now, the elytra is shorter than the width of the elytra. So it's a fairly large family. There's 30,000 species worldwide, 3,200 in North America. This is the largest family in North America. Again, usually easy to recognize, but difficult to define or characterize. They're usually relatively small, 1 to 25 millimeters, elongate, slender beetles. The elytra are usually very short, leaving the at least three abdominal tergites exposed. Mm-hmm. Their antennae are 11 segmented or less. Ocelli are usually not present. Tarsal formula is variable, but usually 5-5-5. The cocci are still fairly prominent, kind of conical and prominent. One thing to note is if you turn them over and count the abdominal segments, usually you can see 6 to 7 abdominal segments. And why I bring that up, the first one may be kind of short, but I bring that up later on, we'll have another family called the Nidodulidae that often has shorter elytra, and they only have 5 abdominal segments. So the 6 to 7 abdominal segments will help separate from the Nidodulids. Again, I don't think the Nidodulids look like staphylinids much, but these occur in just about every type of habitat. Most of them are feed on fungi or pollen. Some are predaceous. A lot of them will just, in the middle top figure, the lateral view, they're kind of showing you, a lot of them kind of run around on the ground with the tip of their abdomen up in the air.
Actually, not the one that I'm mixing up with.
The one you just had up here?
The one from yesterday that I thought was in a different family. I don't know. If I had it, it's more of an eye side. Didn't do anything about it.
Yeah. Some occur in caves. Some live in ant or termite nests. So a lot of different and variable habits and habitats. So next handout. Well, you've got some. There's probably some immatures there. Let's see. We used to have some other families I talked about. Now we go on to the Scarabeoidea. The Scarabeoidea, this superfamily, the adults, they usually only have 3 to 7 segmented antennae. And usually the antennae are kind of clubbed or lamellately clubbed. They're kind of more plate-like and often asymmetrical. Now some, it'll be characteristic that you'll have those flat plate-like asymmetrical club, mm-hmm. and some families can open and close that club, make it look like a tight ball, and some then, but then there's some that can't do that, that they're just kind of an open spaces between the segments. A lot of these families, the legs are somewhat fossorial, meaning that they're fitted with spines and kind of adapted for digging. Most of these families, the tarsal formula is 555. This is kind of a fairly well accepted group, pretty well defined. And there's a number of families we'll talk about. The first one is the Lucanidae, which are the stag beetles. Most of the species in this family are more western North America. Although I used to get them quite commonly in Indiana when I was a kid. They'd come to our lights and that. And we do have a species in North America. It doesn't look, it's smaller and not as interesting looking. A lot of the lucanids have, well, some of the smaller males, their mandibles look normal. The larger males, the mandibles are be huge, like you see in the upper two left-hand corner images. They use those mandibles maybe for fighting and for eating, but they also maybe for sexual attraction. It may be like the antlers on a deer. The larger mandibles may be more attractive to the females. Lucanids. The antennae are somewhat flattened, and the club is not capable of closing into a tight ball. It's usually fairly distinctly elbowed. The first antennal segment is relatively long, and then you can see the others come out at a distinct angle, and then they form that kind of lamellate asymmetrical club, but you can see spaces between the segments, and it can't compact that into a tight ball. In this group, the head usually does not have any horns on it. You'll see why that's important when we talk about the next family, but no horns on the head. The mentum is entire. Remember where I said the mentum was? No, it's on the underneath side. It's the apical part of the labium. And so the distal margin of the mentum is entire. It doesn't have a notch in it. These are brown or blackish in color. A lot of times the elytra is relatively smooth, or in some of these you can see that there's some grooves, but they're not deep grooves. They're be shallow grooved. The larvae feed on juices of decayed wood. Adults possibly feed on honeydew or tree secretions. They're normally found in more forested areas. That's why they're not real common here. We don't have a lot of large forests here. We do, like I said, do have a small species here in North Dakota. But it doesn't usually have the enlarged mandibles and things like that. They're often attracted to lights. The ones in Indiana used to catch at lights a lot. And, you know, they have those large mandibles. And I let them kind of pinch, and they don't hurt. But one time I got one too close to my thumbnail, and it got down into the edge of the thumbnail, and it went down in there, and it did draw a little blood out of them. So, and then the next family is the Passalidae, which are the best beetles or Bessie beetles. This family only has like about four species in North America, but they are fairly common, at least south of here. I'm not sure they quite get to North Dakota, but I've collected Passalids quite often, breaking open dead logs, old rotten logs is where you would find these. The mandibles are not big and as enlarged as in the Lucanids. Again, they look like Lucanids, but now they have very deep grooves on the elytra. So these grooves are very deep Also notice they have a horn on the top of their head. You can see in the lateral view there at the top. Mm-hmm. So they usually have a horn there. They often have a groove on the pronotum down the middle. Uh-huh. And the mentum has a notch in the apical margin. Another way to tell them apart. Again, the antennae, the segments of the club cannot be compacted into a tight ball. And now the antennae, well, the first antennal segment's short. It was long in the Lucanids. And it's not distinctly elbowed. I see the kind of curves around there, but that's often kind of looks more accentuated because of the club, but it's not a sharp elbow like we saw in the Lucanids.
I meant to ask when you first mentioned it, what's the purpose the antenna curling up serves?
Protect the antennas?
Some curling up.
When they can compact into a tight.
I don't know if it's what the purpose would be, whether they can or cannot. I guess as people have just noticed that some families they can and some they cannot, and maybe there is a purpose, but yeah, I don't know. I'd have to look and see if I can find something on that. These occur in rotten logs. They kind of form loose colonies. Very loose. It's not maybe just on the verge of social activity, social behavior, but you never. I think the adults, they can kind of make noises, squeaking noises, stridulation type thing, and it kind of holds the colony together. And they may help feed the larvae. My notes say the larvae are always found with adults. You don't find the larvae by themselves. These are usually not attracted to lights. You never hardly ever find these at lights.
That answered that question.
Oh, you got something at lights that you thought was this?
No, I just was like, is this a possibility? Granted, that's me with every beetle.
Yeah, that's okay. Okay, now this next handout was originally made when the Scarabaeidae was one big family, now with lots of subfamilies.
Wait, oh.
And now they've split a few of these off. And so before we stop talk about the Scarabaeidae, I'm going to talk about the one that's on the top row, second from the left. The Trogidae is now a separate family. Trogidae, and they're commonly called skin beetles. Again, they used to be a subfamily in the Scarabaeidae. They have a relatively distinct appearance. The elytra are kind of roughened and reticulate with ridges and things like that. The second antennal segment does not arise from the apex of the first. So it's like antiapical, like our antiapical claws. The first antennal segment, again, may come up and be something like that, and the second one will come off there. So it doesn't come off the very apex of the first. The abdomen has five or fewer visible sterna, and they're called skin beetles. I was going to say, surely there was something I should say, but second antennal segment does not arise from the first. Anyway, these are called skin beetles because they are attracted to dead carcasses again, but they're one of the last things to come. They show up when flesh is pretty much all rotted away, and all that's left is the skin and bones. And so they feed on the skin and that.
If you're interested in What's it called again? Forensic entomology. This is one of your important ones.
Yeah. If you got skin beetles there, you know the body's been dead for a while. Mm-hmm. Again, this guy I talk about that I collected a lot with down at Louisiana State, Ed Riley. This is one of his groups that he worked on. He liked chrysomelid beetles, but he also really liked scarab beetles. And he would go out and get roadkill animals and then throw them on his roof so they would dry out a little faster than that, so he could catch these skin beetles and stuff. They just hope the sun would dry them out fast. And the common species in the U.S. are in this genus Trox. So Trox beetles. Also, I could just mention it at this point in time. It's not a family that I require, but this picture down in the lower right-hand corner used to be in the scarabs too, but it's been pulled out. It's now the family Geotrupidae. And I think it differs from the others in that, again, most of these other, the scarabs have antennae that are 3 to 7 segmented. This one has an 11 segmented antenna. But it's no longer in the Scarabaeidae, but it's also a family that I don't generally cover. So now, the family Scarabaeidae itself. This is a large family with a lot of subfamilies. Again, some of the other subfamilies have been raised to family level. Most of them are smaller and not as common. There are over 18,000 species worldwide, 1,400 in North America. This is a favorite family for collectors because of the large size and some of the subfamilies. For example, Dynastinae, the upper right-hand corner, have great big horns and ornaments on their pronotum and heads and stuff, and it can be some bright colors. So it's just a popular family. It's fairly well-known group in North Dakota, as a couple of our past graduate students have worked on this family. One of them ended up on the faculty down in Mississippi State, I believe, Paul Legault. And he's got relatives up in Minnesota. He still comes up and visits us every summer and that. So the antennae are lamellate or flabellate. They end in an asymmetrical club of 3 to 7 segments, which they now can flex or compact into a tight ball. The antennae are usually not elbowed. Again, the front tibia are often modified for digging. Size can be quite variable. There's some little tiny ones and then there's some huge ones. I should see if I can find them. I really need to check and make sure dermestids and stuff aren't getting in some of my showy stuff, but I've got some scare beetles that are huge that I caught down in French Guiana on one of my trips. They were coming to our light sheet at night, and you could hear these things coming in. You'd say, oh, here comes another one. It would be this, because they were so big, they made a loud sound as they flew in, and all of a sudden, whack, they'd land on you. They don't bite or anything. It wasn't, but they got something that big, and then the claws would then dig in to just hold on. But we caught a bunch of them. And again, it wasn't my group. Ed Riley was on that trip, so he kept most of them, but I did keep a few. So, but anyway, those were the big ones. Oftentimes the larvae of these things are the white grubs, the kind of C-shaped white grubs. Remember the different larval types, that's named after this, the scarabaeiform. So, again, the biology, ecology is quite diverse. And so I'm going to talk about some of the subfamilies in this group. The first subfamily I'll talk about is the Scarabaeinae, which is the top center Scarabaeinae. Seems like there's the bottom row, second from the left, is the Scarabaeinae. These are commonly called the dung beetles or tumble bugs. And these are the ones that will go and bury dung and that sort of thing in a ball and bury it under the ground and lay their eggs on that. It also includes the sacred scarabs of Egypt.
Free the ancient god.
Yeah. They make balls of dung and bury it where they lay their eggs. Larvae develop on the dung. Again, it reduces competition, keeps the food source a little nicer under the ground. These are usually somewhat broadly rounded, robust beetles. They sometimes have horns on their head and pronotum. Some of them are very beautiful. They can be some metallic greens and things. Here now, in most of these subfamilies, pretty much all of them, I think now the second antennal segment does arise from the apex of the first, so it's not anti-apical. This subfamily, the hind legs tend to be situated way posteriorly on the body. So here you can see the hind legs coming out. The hind legs are closer to the posterior end of the body than they are to the middle legs. All of the abdominal spiracles are usually covered by the elytra. And the antennal club is often pubescent or has hairs on it. The next subfamily I'll talk about is the Melanthini, which is on the upper row, far to the left, is a Melanthini, and then top row, second from the right, is a Melanthini. These are the June beetles and chafers. But the kind of brown or reddish brown or light brown beetles you often see in the springtime comes to lights fairly commonly. They call them June beetles, or sometimes they're called May beetles, maybe, but. It's in this subfamily, the Melanthini. This is the really characteristic white C-shaped grub that can be sometimes a pest. We have some that attack corn roots and that around here. Some of them are pests, can be pests on turf grass, feeding on the roots under the lawns and that sort of thing. Melanthini, this is a large, widely distributed group. The members are plant feeders. Again, the second antennal segment arises from the apex of the first. The hind legs are not way back on the back of the body now. That's how it differs from the Scarabaeinae. Also, at least one spiracle is exposed. They're not all covered up by the elytra. The antennal club is usually not pubescent or only has a few sparse hairs. And then in this subfamily, the tarsal claws are toothed or bifid. So the tarsal claw will come out here and it'll have a tooth like that. That'd be one of them. So they'll be toothed or bifid tarsal claws.
What's the second term used?
Bifid. We probably used that term way back when we talked about crustaceans. Mm-hmm. Most of the appendages were bifid. They'd go out and then split into two. Mm-hmm. Tooth would be a small tooth. Bifid would probably indicate that it was more two longer. Might almost start looking like four claws, but. And again, the common genus is this, what you see in the upper left, this Phyllophaga, is what has most of the June beetles on it. And actually, that's what probably got Ed Reilly interested in this. That was his master's project, is that he did a paper on the Phyllophaga of Louisiana, which there was a lot of species down there, so it was a big project. But the next subfamily we'll talk about is the Dynastinae, which is the upper right-hand corner. Is that the only one on this thing? I think so. The Dynastinae. These are the rhinoceros beetles, Hercules beetles, elephant beetles. These are some of the really big, showy, spectacular ones. Contain some of the largest species. They essentially possess the characters of the Melanthinae, except that the tarsal claws are now simple. So essentially the same characters that we in the last subfamily, the Melanthinae, except now the tarsal claws are simple. These also tend, the top of the body is kind of rounded, not at all flattened. The reason we mention that is because in the next subfamily, the top, the dorsal surface of the body is more or less flattened. Still in the Dynastinae, again, males will often have horns on the head and or the thorax. And then the subfamily Cetaneae is on the bottom row, third from the right. These are kind of the, called the flower beetles. You do often find them sitting on flowers in that sort of situation. Now, like I said, they have the kind of the same characters as the Dynastinae, except the top dorsal surface is flattened. They're relatively flat on top, and there's often a little indentation. Oh, it's not easy to see in here, but it's kind of a hollowed out shallow area on each side of the elytra. So they have the characteristics of the Dynastinae, except the dorsal surface of the body is usually flattened, and there's usually a shallow margination in the elytra just behind the humeral angles. These feed primarily on pollen and are some of the most frequently collected, or they're frequently collected on flowers. This one, this family, subfamily, contains one in the south called the green June. There's one called the green June bug, and it is a green color. And its dorsal surface is more flat. Doesn't really look like the brown June beetles that we're familiar with. But this is a green one. It's a flat one. It's real common in the south. My wife, who grew up in Alabama, she said, as a kid, they used to catch them all the time, and they'd take one of their long hairs and form like a lasso and tie it around the body, and then it would try to fly. It's like you were flying a green June bug. But anyway, that's what she grew up. If you'd ask her what a June beetle was, that's what she would have told you. It was those green ones, not the brown ones, because it was so common down there. And then the last subfamily I want to talk about is the Rutilinae, which is the lower left-hand corner and the one in the middle of the bottom row. The Rutilinae, these are called the shining leaf chafers. In this subfamily, the two claws are not of the same length. So one claw will be long and one will be short. So the two claws are not the same length. So claws of both middle and hind tarsi, unequal in length. Many of these are larvae feed on plant roots, and the adults are plant feeders. The main reason we include this family is this one in the lower left-hand corner. Do you guys recognize it at all? It's the Japanese beetle.
An important pest.
Which, yes, is an important pest. It's Charles. You know Charles? We're running traps. He runs traps all over the place for this because it has been brought in a number of years ago. I think it was here a long time ago and kind of got exterminated or that, and now it's back. Was brought in on nursery stock, and I think mostly over in West Fargo we're still catching it in some, and maybe some other places in the state. I haven't kept up with it, but it's those green and yellow traps that Charles, you see around the city all over the place. He gave me one a long time ago. And there's a pheromone, a bait you can put in them to try to attract them. That's what I had one that I was running in my backyard for him. So I've never caught him up here. But it is one of the, when I was a young child, I remember catching the first one of these. They were common in Indiana. And they were a problem pest in Indiana. But as I was a child, my family, we were always baseball fans. And went to Cincinnati Reds games down in Cincinnati, Ohio. And we were down there and they were flying everywhere. And that's where I caught my first Japanese beetle. At the ballpark, sitting there watching the Cincinnati Reds play. They flew in and said, oh, this is a cool thing. Because they are pretty. They're kind of metallic greenish with some other colors and white spots and stuff. So this one in the middle is the genus Pelidnota. And we do have a species of it in North Dakota. It's a little bit larger and kind of a light brown color with some of those black spots on it. Down in Mexico and southeastern or southwestern United States, there's a genus. Now it's called Chrysina. It used to be Plusiotis, which there's some spectacular colored things. And I've got some. Again, if I can find them, I should bring them in. But they're colored like silver or gold aluminum foil. And then there's some that are lime green and silver striped, and some with blue legs, and just, yeah, some really beautiful scarabs in this subfamily. So anyway, that's the scarab beetles. Let's see. Again, on Fridays, I don't want to usually take us over too long, but I got a mark in my notes where I got to one other time. And if I do one more family, I'll get to the same place. So let's do one more family. Your next handout's on the Sciurtidae. We used to require that, but it's not very common in that, so we've taken it off the required list. So you're not required to know the Sciurtidae. So now that takes us to the Buprestoidea. And the one family that we'll talk about in the Buprestoidea is the Buprestidae.
No.
What's that?
That's why these are familiar. They're tree borers. Buprestids.
Yep. Yeah, these, again, it's another popular family for collectors. When I say for collectors, I'm usually talking about kind of amateur collectors that are collecting just because they want wowy, showy things. But down in the tropics in Southeast Asia, some of these are huge and beautifully marked and brilliant colors and things. But these are the metallic wood boring beetles. The larvae are often called flat headed borers. There's about 15,000 species worldwide. Some are brilliantly colored. The head tends to be hyponathous, mouth parts projecting downwards, and the head looks like it's somewhat sunken into the pronotum. So you don't see a lot of the head from above. The antennae are relatively short and more serrate. Serrate's kind of more saw-like or toothed. The pronotum has a posterior interlocking device, and the lateral edges are incomplete. I mean, it may be edged partly. And the pronotum, I think there's just some structures on the back edge that may interlock with the elytra a little bit. I need to check on that because I'd marked it out and said prosternum, but then I go ahead and talk about the prosternum in the next sentence in my notes. So, but these often are kind of like the click beetles, has the prosternum projecting down between the coccyx. And but it doesn't really have an interlocking device. It doesn't click or jump like the click beetles do. So the prosternum is long in front of the coccyx and just a broad, and has a broad intercoccyx process received by the mesosternum or sometimes the metasternum. These usually have the metasternum usually has that transverse suture we talked about. This I also mentioned in the introductory lecture that the first two abdominal segments are somewhat semi-fused. At least the suture between the first and second segments is much less distinct than it is between the other segments. Tarsal formula is 5-5-5. Usually there's only, you can see five abdominal sterna, maybe because those first two look fused. These are interesting in that they're very active flyers, but they will fly with their elytra in resting position, not flared out like the others. There's actually a little emargination at each, so they may raise their elytra up a little bit, the wings, the hind wings fold out, and then they put those back down. So the wings will stick out in flying position, but the elytra will still be more or less in resting position.
So it doesn't sort of incapacitate them at all, it's kind of
folded out. It still manages it somehow, yeah. And they're good flyers, they're pretty good flyers, so. So during flight, the elytra are lifted slightly but remain closed, the wings protruding below and marginations behind humeri. These are often black or yellowish in color. There's a lot of species that are black or yellow in color. Some may be kind of like mimics of wasps and bees. They usually feed on the nectar of flowers. I have caught a lot of these on flowers, especially down in the southwestern United States. Those black and yellow ones, some with some reddish markings, would be often on a lot of different flowers down there. The larvae feed on both living and dead plant material, often under the bark or boring into the trees and stems. And so there are some economically important pests. There's one around here called the bronze birch borer that really is a problem on birch trees. The adults are only out for a week or two, and so the immatures, you know, what I'm getting at is it's hard to control them using insecticides unless you've got a really good systemic. But most of the time the adults aren't around very long. They're inside the trees. In fact, what I've heard is the best control for the bronze birch borer is just making sure that you keep your birch tree good and healthy. Mm-hmm. You know, keep it well watered, keep it fertilized, plenty of sun. And because these things tend to, you know, we'll see a lot of times, so in high populations, they may start attacking better, healthier trees. But most of these wood boring beetles and things like that, even bark beetles and that, they tend to attack weak trees, dead, dying trees, diseased trees first, and then in larger numbers they'll start hitting healthier trees. But also, of course, you've heard in the news for quite some time now about the emerald ash borer too, is in this group. It's one of the things that we're watching for. Again, Charles puts out that the traps for the emerald ash borer are those big purple triangular, big purple, they're like sticky traps. But these tend to be attracted to that sort of a trap. So there was one, if you walk between here and the Blue Roof Inn, he had one this summer on a tree just right here close to where I park. But I don't think it's here yet. It's definitely in the cities and up into parts of Minnesota and that. But we haven't had the Emerald Ash Borer up here yet. So anyway, that's where I was going to quit. That finishes. It's a good stopping point. Next time we'll start with the super family Beeroidea and actually go back into a couple aquatic families, the Elmidae and the Dryopidae and that. So any questions on today's material?
So Stamina is further different, so the vitamins and tribes, correct?
Say that again.
Is it Scarabidae or Scarabina that are kind of divided further into tribes?
I don't know. I mean, for our purposes, the Scarabaeidae, the family, and then I talked about some subfamilies. That would be the Scarabaeinae and Rutilinae and Dynastinae. Now, each one of those may have tribes below that. I don't know. I would be very surprised if they didn't have tribes. So they probably do have, but so. Yeah, family, then subfamily, then tribe is the next step down. Tribes between subfamily and genus.